Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. Our theme for this show is Epic Fail.
We'll hear stories of screw-ups, mix-ups, and clean-ups.
A warm welcome to our first storyteller, Joshua Bassett. Through his work in marketing, he's met some pretty interesting characters. Here's just one story.
There are times in life when you say something that you immediately regret. And I have a story about the one time when I said something and it's like, that's it. I completely regret this comment. And it happened back in, it was 2012. And I was in Phoenix, Arizona. And I was working as a marketing manager for Coca-Cola with the Vitamin Water and Smart Water brands. And I was dealing with a lot of pro athletes at the time, and one of the characters that really stood out was a football player named Daryl. And Daryl's not his real name, however, it's his name for this story. So, Daryl, he's a beast. He's 6'4", 295, and the man is just absolutely covered in tattoos. And he's a all-pro defensive end. Made over $50 million in his career. Like, the guy is an absolute baller. So, those who know Daryl know that he's crazy, like Mike Tyson type of crazy. And like Tyson, he actually has a pet tiger and a pet alligator, and he's just a personality that you don't want to mess with. So, I had three conversations with Daryl, and this was conversation number one. So, I ring him up on the phone, and he answers, and he says, "Who dis?" And I go, "Hey, what up, Daryl? This is Josh calling with Coca-Cola. Spoke to your agent this morning, and he said to give you a call to get you hooked up with some product." So we had a little small talk, and then I ask him, "Are there any particular flavors of vitamin water that you want the team to drop off?" And what he said next really impressed me, because he goes, "Revive. I love how it has 850 milligrams of potassium and 30 milligrams of niacin. And Triple X, how it's blueberry, pomegranate, acai flavored, and has 60 milligrams of vitamin C." And I'm like, impressive stuff, Daryl. Like, you know exactly what you're consuming. You know exactly what you're putting in your body. So he then says, "And the coconut flavor vitamin water." And I go, "Hey, buddy, we do not have a coconut flavor vitamin water." "You do have a coconut flavor vitamin water." And I go, "No, you're thinking of Vita Coco. We're vitamin water. It is a completely different company." And he says, "I will bet you $20,000 that you have a coconut flavor vitamin water." And this is the moment when I say something that I absolutely regret, because I say, "Hey, Daryl, I'm not a pro athlete and I can't throw around $20,000. However, I will put my 1998 red Honda Civic on the line against your $20,000. And he says, "Okay, I'll take that bet. And when you lose, I want you to call me back and apologize to me." So I'm like, "Oh God, okay, just tell me when and where the team needs to be to drop off your product." And he says, "Call me back on Sunday and I'll give you the details." So I get off the phone and I'm thinking, do we have a coconut flavored vitamin water? And I'm like, man, this isn't, you know. So I call up my boss and the phone rings and he picks up. And I'm like, "Hey, do we have a coconut flavored vitamin water?" And he goes, "Yes, we do. It's in the trial phase right now. You can only get it in New York, and if it performs well, we're going to roll it out to additional markets. So I'm like, oh man, this is not positive stuff right now. Because I knew I had to call him back and apologize, which is what I do. So this is conversation number two with Daryl. Give him a call. And he picks up and goes, "Who dis?" And I say, "Hey, Daryl, this is Josh calling you back because you're right. We do have a coconut flavor vitamin water, and I'm here to apologize to you because it's only available in New York. It's in a trial phase right now. So just calling to let you know." And he says, "I want that pink slip," referring to the title of the vehicle. And I say, "Well, you know, my wife, she's in her graduate program right now, and she kind of, you know, takes the car to and from her program." "Well, if you won the bet, you'd want my $20,000. And I'm just thinking, this is not good. I'm like, "Dude, we were just joking around, right?" And he goes, "Nah, you know what I'm going to do with that red 1998 Honda Civic? I'm going to give it to one of my boys to drive around town." I'm like, "Ugh." He goes, No. "I'm going to sell it for a couple $1,000 and donate that money to children in the ghetto." And I just think, okay, well, how about we just continue this conversation on Sunday when I call you back? So I hang up, and we get off the phone. And I'm just thinking, this is not a good situation because I am immediately freaked out. And my blood pressure and anxiety are at an all-time high because I had 5 days until Sunday, and that's when I knew that I had to call him back. So another thing that pops in my head is like, could I be fired for this? Like, this is not a good thing, and my wife is gonna kill me. So I actually pull out my phone, and I text my wife, and I say, "Hey, baby, what's up? I think I just gambled away our car to a crazy NFL player. My bad. XOXO. So Sunday comes along, and I pick up the phone, and it rings, and he does not pick up. And I'm relieved. I'm like, all right, he doesn't pick up. This is a good thing. So a day passes, and 2 days pass, and 3 days, and on the fifth day, I get a text, and I look at my phone, and it says, "Yo." So I'm like, oh man, this is the moment. This is it. So I pick up the phone, and I call him up, and he answers, and he says, "Who dis?" I'm like, "Dude, you just texted me 10 seconds ago." He goes, "Who dis?" And he goes, "Hey, man, I got to call you back in a couple minutes." And I say, "That's fine. Call me back." And that was the last time I spoke to Daryl. I had my assistant resume all communication with the man. I sold the Civic a couple years later, and some 20-year-old in Colorado is driving that around. And as for me, well, I always make sure to text my wife before making a bet involving one of our vehicles. Thank you.
This is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour, where we hear true stories told by Alaskans. We just heard from Joshua Bassett. It seems like what we can learn from the storytellers on this show is that epic fails lead to epic life lessons.
Our next storyteller is a high school teacher. And like any good teacher, Katie Isis wants her students to learn from her mistakes. Here she is with a story about learning the hard way.
So I grew up watching a lot of Disney movies. And by watching a lot of Disney movies, I mean that's all I watched. So I didn't watch Saturday morning cartoons. I still haven't seen Back to the Future. But I have seen The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, and Cinderella more times than there are people in this theater. So at the age of about 4, I had planned out how my life was going to look. So I was going to go to college, and I'm going to get a job, a degree in something I can get a job in, and I'm going to meet someone, and then we're going to get married, and then we're going to get jobs, and we're going to get a house. The house is going to have a white picket fence, and then we're going to live happily ever after. So when I went to college, I was on the lookout for the person that I could insert into this story that was going to make this fairy tale come true. So my junior year of college, I met that person. And he was tall, and he was handsome, and he was really intelligent. So about a year into our relationship, I was ready to get married. So after a little convincing, he said, let's go pick out a ring. So we go to the jewelry store, and they're going to make this ring for me, and I have 2 weeks to wait. So in that 2 weeks' time, I've racked through every Disney movie I've ever seen, imagining what this proposal is going to look like. So a couple weeks go by, and he comes home one day, and I'm sitting on the couch, and he puts a small square box on the entertainment center. And I look at him, and I look at the box, and all of my hopes and dreams for this romantic proposal are melting into the couch. And then he says, aren't you going to go open it up? So reluctantly, I walk over, I open it up, I see the shiny diamond ring, I put it on my finger, I'm super excited, and I'm getting married. So about a year later, the giant poofy white dress wedding happens with all of the pomp and circumstance you can possibly choke on. And about a year into our relationship, things are going all right, and then it starts to get to where I'm counting how many times a week we're having sex so we don't have to have sex again. He's complaining about me always counting how many times we're having sex, and I always reply, I'm a math teacher, I just count things. So 4 years into our marriage, we go on a trip with my family to Moab, Utah, and my brother and his girlfriend are there, my sister and her boyfriend, and my parents. And we're supposed to go jeeping at 8 a.m. one morning, and 8 a.m. rolls around, and the husband and I are the only people awake, and he's frustrated. And when he gets frustrated, instead of like just, you know, fidgeting, he starts throwing a temper tantrum. So I spend the entire day in a Jeep with him complaining either about how we hadn't left on time that day or not talking to me. And I find myself sitting with a 27-year-old man boy throwing a temper tantrum, and I have a cliff to my left, and it's 300 feet down, and I think, yeah, I don't know. I think this cliff looks pretty good to me right now. So I go home from that trip, and I'm really discouraged. And so I decide to go see a therapist. Maybe there's something I need to look at. So a couple months into therapy, I walk into her office, sit down on the couch. I look at her, and I say, I'm done with this marriage. I don't want to be in it anymore. And after the longest pause, she says, Kate, have you tried this and this and this and this? And lists about 7 things to try. And I'm frustrated because I'm done. But being the studious student I am, I go home and I try those things. And one of the things she had asked me to try was to write down all the things in my life on index cards. So I get 3x5 index cards, I get my purple grape-scented Mr. Sketch marker, and I start listing things out. Husband, house, car. I write down my dog's name, and I'm bawling because I can't imagine giving her up. And I list things in my house, like my beautiful peeled spruce bed frame, and my dishes, and my quilts, and everything I own. And I look at them, and I think, I'm not really sure what I actually want. So the answer comes a few months later, when I'm out in the boat with my family, and over breakfast one morning, the husband decided it was an appropriate time to start listing all the things that I was doing wrong in our relationship. I wasn't making dinner on time, I wasn't cleaning the bathroom correctly, and the list goes on. And I went home from that trip, and I was like, I think I'm done. So a few days later, I sent him a text, and I asked him to meet me at Moose's Tooth. So he meets me at Moose's Tooth, and we get seated in the news section of Moose's Tooth. So we're in one of those two-person booths. So we order a couple beers, a Moose Ranch salad, and avalanche pizza, because that's what we always ordered. And right as the pizza arrived, I'm thinking, how am I going to tell him what I need to tell him? And so as the pizza is being set on the table, I just blurt out, I'm done. And then there's silence. And more silence. And I'm looking around, and he hangs his head, and I'm watching the waiters walk by bringing other people pizza, and I'm looking at my uneaten pizza, wishing I could eat it, but figuring it probably wasn't a good time to start eating. And then I'm watching people go to the bathroom, and I'm watching people come back from the bathroom. And then I'm like, I've got to get out of here. This is not fun. So I get a hold of the waiter's attention, give him my credit card. They bring me a box up the pizza, and we leave the restaurant in silence. We get out to the parking lot, and the only thing he says to me is, why did you have to ruin Moose's tooth for me? So I drive away with the pizza, because I still have not eaten at this point, and I move out the next day, and I move into a friend's house, and I'm unpacking my things at her house, and I find the index cards. And so I lay them out, and it becomes very clear what I actually want. I wanted my car, and I wanted my dog. And so while I didn't get that fairy tale ending, reality is so much better. Thank you.
That was Katie Isis, and this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. Our theme for this show is Epic Fail, stories of screw-ups, mix-ups, and clean-ups.
Our next storyteller first told his story at an open mic when the New York-based storytelling event, The Moth, came to Anchorage. Though a little embarrassing, Jaron Saturnino was kind enough to repeat the story for us on Arctic Entries.
I'm the worst Alaskan. I know this because I've lived in Alaska my entire life, so I'm pretty qualified, right? So growing up, I was an indoors kid. My parents had to drag me kicking and screaming to experience the great Alaskan wilderness. When they finally did, they brought me fishing, but whenever we went fishing, we took a motorhome. So it's like we experienced the outdoors, but I spent most of it indoors anyway. See, to me, camping was this thing, this weird thing that my white friends did. Like, to me, the only reason anyone would ever want to go camping is to have sex in a tent. Seriously, camping, sex in a tent. So I'm going to start this story somewhere out of high school, somewhere in college. Girlfriend at the time, long distance from Juneau, and oh my God, we were so in love. After a year of messaging on and off, OkCupid, text messages, all sorts of things, she was finally going to visit Anchorage. And you know what? When you're truly in love, anything is possible, especially camping. Also, this is a virginity story. And this virginity story starts off where all great virginity stories start. Tolkitna. We had the best possible night planned out. I brought my guitar, camping gear, a cooler with this meal that I designed. It was like salmon, asparagus, couscous, all the works, right? And also a 5-gallon jug of water that we never actually opened. But anyway, it was going to be the best night ever. We were going to sing Bob Dylan songs into the sunset, the Tolkitna sunset, which is the best possible sunset in Alaska. I don't care where else you come from. But it was supposed to be the best night of our lives. But I'm here right now. Problem number one, we couldn't get the campfire started. I don't know, I spent like an hour looking up how to start a campfire on YouTube. Like, I remember doing that, right? And like, in my head, it'd be easy, and just, we couldn't get it. Like, there was actually a point where like, I took the peanut oil, from the meal that I prepped, and I like just dumped it onto the campfire and like lit, tried to light it. It just didn't work. Nothing, none of the kindling was going on, and I don't know. We were really hungry at the time because we had driven to Talkeetna, and then problem number two. It starts raining. It's like right out of a movie. It just starts raining and raining and raining. And we're just like, oh my God, we're gonna go to bed hungry. No more Bob Dylan. No more songs into the sunset. Well, let's just get drunk. Now, when you're under the age of 21, any alcohol is amazing. And this alcohol was super special because a year before, I was at a Reddit meetup, and there was this guy who brewed his own port wine. And like he had us all taste it, and like I got really excited about it because, you know, I was under the age of 21. So he decides, hey, I think you should have this. And he gives me a giant bottle of port wine. And I look at him and I say, you know you can get in trouble for this, right? And he's like, I know. This is a great thing that you're bestowing upon me. I know. So, of course, you're going to save this for the best possible night of your life. And so, like, corkscrew in. Problem number three. The corkscrew breaks inside of the cork. And we're just like, oh no, what do we do? I'm so sorry, Redditor. And we just look at it, and we decide that the most sane thing to do, like, I looked this up on YouTube afterwards. Afterwards, YouTube is only useful after things happen. But we look at it, and we decide, let's just take a rock and break it open. So we do, and wine gets on my favorite outfit. Of course you wear your favorite outfit too, best possible night. And we're just like, okay, we need something to drink it out of. And we look around our supplies, and number four, we didn't bring anything to drink it out of. So imagine this, like we pour it into these styrofoam bowls that we brought for breakfast the next day. And you know, we're just getting more wine onto our outfits, you know? And at this point, we're kind of drunk and like laughing about things that, you know, this should have turned out better. And we go into the tent, we're just cuddling up, and she's telling me stories of, you know, how back in Juneau, how her family took her out camping and how this isn't how it's supposed to be. That's when number five occurs to me. I forgot the sleeping bag. So at this point, we're just, you know, cuddling, and she starts crying, and I start crying because she's crying, and because I'm crying, she starts crying. And here's the thing. How many times throughout my life have I made that joke that the only reason people go camping is to have sex in a tent? I made it all the time around her, and because we had planned it that way, like, we were going to have sex in a tent, and it just occurs to us, we're gonna try. Number six, we try. And it's painful and it hurts, and she's crying because this was supposed to be the best night of her life, and she's not happy, and I'm crying because it's supposed to be the best night of my life because I'm not, and we're not happy, and we just keep crying and crying, and it hurts and it hurts. Eventually we give up, and we give up, as in, we don't want to deal with the cold tent, we don't want to deal with the fact that we didn't have sleeping bags. We go into my car, into the back door of a cramped sedan, and we try to get some sleep there. I wake up the next morning. Number seven, by the way, car battery died. But I wake up the next morning. She's nowhere to be found, my girlfriend. I look around, and then I realize, oh, she's at the campsite that we that we were at. And there she is. She's smiling. She was able to get the campfire started. And it's all blazing. She's giving me the biggest grin in the world because I am the worst Alaskan.
You just heard Jaron Saturnino on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Just a quick reminder that all the past Arctic Entries stories are available for listening on our website, arcticentries.com, as well as through iTunes and SoundCloud. You can listen to this show in its entirety at alaskapublic.org.
Our next storyteller is Joe Meehan, who moved to Alaska 30 years ago in search of some wild experiences.
So like many of us, we live in Alaska for the outdoor adventures it affords us, out in the wild areas and the mountains. And partaking in these adventures obviously comes with some risk and potential hazards, but we try to mitigate those. Sometimes we survive them by just dumb luck. And for those of us that are parents, adds another risk, element of risk when we're out in wild areas with our kids. So this story is about my four-year-old son, when he was 4 years old, Willem, along with my former wife, Laura, and a buddy of mine, Bill. And we loaded up two sea kayaks on the beach in Valdez and stuffed the kid in the big cockpit of the double boat, paddled 10 miles out into Prince William Sound into Shoup Bay, and spent the day exploring the bay and the Tidewater Glacier, and then started to look for a campsite for the night. And so we landed on a beach about a quarter mile away from the face of the glacier and found a good site. We unloaded the boats and moved the boats and all the gear up off from the water's edge because we didn't want a wave from the calving glacier to come over and get our gear wet and wash it away on us. But it was late in the day, and so Laura and Bill decided it was time to get dinner going, which was easier to do down by the water. So they started unpacking the stove and the food and getting all the gear ready for dinner while I busied myself hauling the gear inland to a campsite we picked out. And after I made about three loads up to the campsite with Willem just playing on the beach and climbing on boulders and playing in the sand, I turned as I heard the glacier start to calve behind me. And it was a spectacular sight to see that glacier calve from one side of the bay all the way across the face of that glacier, a third of a mile long. And then it calved back the other way. And then the other way, and back and forth, and back and forth. The glacier just kept calving into Shoup Bay. It was a major surge of Shoup Glacier into the bay, and like a loaf of sliced bread, the glacier just kept peeling and peeling and peeling. The sound and the noise was deafening as house and vehicle-sized chunks of ice were crashing into the bay and then themselves rolling and breaking into smaller and smaller icebergs. It was like thunder and gunshots all going off at the same time. Spray going hundreds of feet into the air, forming a double rainbow. It was a spectacular scene to see. However, I knew the short distance we moved the boats and the gear was not going to be enough. So I immediately started running as fast as I could down to the gear, shouting to Bill and Laura, "The gear, the gear." But of course they couldn't hear me because the noise was so deafening. Finally, they realized what I was doing and they came over and we frantically started throwing all the loose gear into the hatches and the cockpit of the boat. And I kept looking out into the bay waiting for that wave to come, which was probably going to dump up on the beach and wash our gear and get stuff wet. Call the splash wave. And I kept looking for that splash wave, but it never came. Something else did. I knew we were in trouble when I saw the water line recede out into the bay about 50 feet. There was a mini tsunami coming from the displacement of the ice. Just like when you slide into the bathtub, the entire basin of Shoup Bay was sloshing towards us. And at lightning speed, a head-high wall of water came barreling over the top of the three of us, tumbling us head over heels, smashing us into the rocks, into the beach. This was a situation for survival. We were struggling to stay on top, to breathe. At one point, I came to the surface. I got hit in the head with one of the boats, and Laura screamed out. And when I heard her scream, it took me out of that survival bubble that I was in, trying to save my own skin, and I remembered the rest of the members of our party. And that's when it hit me, is where's the kid? And the feeling of helplessness and fear was so overwhelming at that point. I started screaming out, "Willem! Willem!" Of course, I couldn't move. I was at the mercy of this wave being dragged up the beach. Finally, I could see Willem out in front of the wave, running as fast as his four-year-old legs would take him, away from the wave, carrying his little snack bag that he had been eating out of. But he wasn't running fast enough. The wave was gaining on him, and I knew it was going to overtake him at this rate. All I wanted to do was to get out of that water and go save my kid, and now I'm anger and the adrenaline and the frustration is overwhelming me. And I knew if that wave had hit him, it was not going to be survivable. Either he'd drown or the ragdoll trauma of getting smashed around was going to kill him. And it was the worst feeling in the world to see your kid about ready to get hit by this wave. This wave eventually went 350 feet inland. That's a football field plus the end zones. Fortunately, as the wave reached its maximum inland extent, it was decreasing in magnitude, in size, and velocity, to the point where finally I could touch the ground, and then where I could actually get footing, control what was happening to me, start to move through that water, start to run through that water, finally get up there, grab my kid, and get him out of harm's way. He was so proud of himself as he showed off that bag of snacks that he saved it from that wave that was trying to get him. So we ended up camping that night, well inland from the water's edge. And although we were banged up, we were bruised, we were bloodied, clothes were torn, some gear was lost and damaged, we were relatively okay. Nothing broken, no concussions, kid didn't get hit. And as we sat there that night watching the beauty of the bay and just taking in the scene, and as Willem slept in the tent nearby, listening to his breathing, it made us feel really lucky and realize just how close we had come to getting severely injured, but how close we also came to losing our son. And what saved us was just dumb luck. Now, my son Willem's approaching 17 years of age now, and he's got a few broken bones in his background, some scars and stitches to show off all these adventures that we've been on. And now that he's taller than I am, it's going to be him that's dragging me out onto these wilderness adventures. And Willem, the only thing I ask is if you kill me out there, please make sure it's doing something fun. I love you, buddy.
That was wildlife biologist and park ranger Joe Meehan. And this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Next, we'll hear from Ira Perman, who's a 40-year resident of Spinard and dedicated supporter of the arts in Alaska.
Story is about my first trip to Whittier. 1975, I'm brand new in Alaska, and I'm poor. So when my landlord offers me and my friend Kevin $100 each to go down to Whittier and bring his furniture from his condo back to Anchorage, we took the offer. So it's a Sunday morning, and we're driving down to Whittier, or to Portage, in a rented flatbed truck. That's the kind of truck that has a platform behind the cab and nothing else. And in those days, you couldn't drive your truck or car through the tunnel. You had to put it on the Alaska Railroad car and they would pull you through. And also in those days, it only ran on Saturdays and Sundays. It would go in on in the morning to Whittier and come back at promptly at 5 o'clock. And this was a Sunday, we had to do the job in one day. It was getting to be winter, and on the Portage side, it was kind of gray and cool, but when we got through the other side to Whittier, you probably heard about Whittier weather, it was raining, it was snowing, it was sleeting, and it was going all sideways all at the same time. Just lousy, typical Whittier weather. Well, we hightailed it over to the condo. Oh, if you're thinking, condo? In Whittier? What is it? What's he talking about? Well, you've probably all seen that big tall building in Whittier, the 11-story concrete thing. Well, that's the condo. It used to be an army barracks, but after the war, they sold it off as condos. And now, then, all 140 people of Whittier lived in that one building. These are 140 people who live over there to be away from humanity, but somehow they all live together in the same building. Couldn't quite figure this out. Well, we went to work. His condo was up on the 7th floor, and you could only get up and down via a really slow, small elevator, and the place was packed with furniture, a lot of it antiques, including one beautiful antique, a red velvet love seat, just gorgeous. Well, we start taking this stuff down the elevator. It's going really slow. It's taking too long. 3 o'clock comes along, and we're just barely halfway done. We picked up the pace. We moved as fast as we could, stuff more in the elevator. At 5 minutes to 5, we finally get the last piece of furniture onto the truck, and it's the red velvet love seat. We cover the whole thing with a blue tarp, tie it down, and we just make a beeline for the train depot. And I'm just driving like a madman. It's raining, and the windshield wipers are going back and forth. I'm driving through slush puddles and everything. And I can see the train up ahead, and it's already loaded, ready to move out. What I didn't see was the pothole. The deepest, biggest, slushiest filled pothole I've ever hit. Truck-sized pothole. The truck dove into the pothole. And as the back end came catapulting out, I looked in the rearview mirror, and I could see tables and chairs ripping through the blue tarp. And there, high above them all, was the red velvet love seat. I could see it in slow motion, end over end, off the truck into the pothole. Kersplush. We missed the train. We reloaded the wet, broken furniture on the truck, went back to the condo, and slept upstairs on the floor. The next morning, the weather had changed. It had gotten colder, and all that rain from the night before had frozen on the trees and the wires and telephones, and the sun had come out. So it was just sparkling. It was just gorgeous, truly magical. And so we said, well, we're here till Saturday, the next Saturday. Let's go out and explore. Well, we did, but there's not that much to explore in Whittier if you've been there. There's the abandoned Buckner building. There's the harbor. There's a small cafe and two bars. Well, by early afternoon, we'd done all there was to do in Whittier. And we had become the talk of the town. News spreads fast when you all live in one building. You know, it's an interesting place. There are people who are a little strange in Whittier. When that last train pulls out on Sunday and all the regular folks go back to Anchorage, the Whittier people let their weirdness fly. It reminds me of one of my favorite movies called King of Hearts. It takes place in World War II in a French town, and the wardens of an insane asylum have fled the advancing Germans, leaving the inmates in charge of the asylum. Well, it's Wednesday morning, we're bored, and the phone rings in the condo, and it's a guy from the Alaska Railroad says, hey, I'm Jim, I'm the engineer here stationed in Whittier, and I'll bet you guys are real bored and wishing it was Saturday. I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna put a train together just for you and take you out of here. Wow, that's amazing. He said, meet me 15 minutes at the depot. So we took the truck down the depot, and sure enough, there's our train. One engine, one flat car. The engine's gonna pull us backwards through the tunnel, and the flat car, about 80 feet long, has two tall steel walls on either end with ladders going up the sides. Well, we drive on, and the first thing we notice, it's glare ice. Just glare ice, and we just nose the truck into place, and Jim, the engineer, starts pulling us through the tunnel, and as we go through the tunnel, he can't see us, we can't see him. We can see all the sharp rocks on the walls and the ceiling, but we're going through the tunnel and thinking, man, this is great, we're high-fiving. Where else could this happen but in Alaska? The train's picking up speed, and it's rocking and rocking and rocking and rocking, and as it starts to rock, we start to notice it's starting to move. The truck is sliding to the left. I'm in the driver's seat. I'm going to hit the wall. And we realize, you know, we're not going to make it through the tunnel. It's going to slide off. We're going to hit that sharp wall of rocks. It's going to drag the truck to a stop. The back of the train's going to hit us, smash us like a beer can. All that furniture's going to be candlesticks, and we're going to be history. This is for real. So I'm flashing the lights, honking the horn, but Jim can't see us or hear us, of course. And I can't get out my side because I'm about a foot from the wall at that point. So my friend Kevin did a very brave thing. He jumped out his truck door, and was heading for that ladder to try and get up on top of that wall there and warn the engineer. But as soon as he hit the flat part, his legs went out from it, and he couldn't move. He just couldn't go. He could get no traction. So what did he do? He did something I've never seen before. He did a perfect impersonation of a halibut flopping in the bottom of your boat. And he flop, 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 all the way to that ladder, climbed the ladder. He's ducking the rocks at the top. He's staring right into the headlight of the train, looking at Jim in the cockpit there, and screams, "Stop the train!" Jim hits the brakes. Me and the truck, we go sailing forward, smashed into the front wall, clang, just beneath Kevin's legs. The whole thing came to a stop, and when it stopped, the wheels of the truck were halfway off the train. We crept out of that tunnel at a snail's pace. When we got to the other side, we thanked Jim for his great adventure for us. And the story comes to an end back in Anchorage, where we delivered the pieces of furniture. My landlord was not very happy, but we didn't ask for our $100. See, we were just failures as furniture movers. But that first trip to Whittier, man, that was epic.
You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage, and that was Spinard resident Ira Perman.
Now we'll hear from Addison Hayden. If Addison isn't already on an adventure, you'll find her daydreaming about her next trip.
Here she is to teach us a little about having fun.
My best friend from college once informed me that there are actually two types of fun. She said there's type one fun, which is a kind of fun that's easy, it's effortless, and it's absolutely enjoyable. And examples of this might be any time that you're hanging out with your friends and family. Maybe you're playing cards, maybe you're drinking, but it's those times where you find yourself uncontrollably laughing, and the fun just seems effortless. And she went on to say that then there's type two fun. And this kind of fun is a little different. So it usually takes effort, it's difficult, but at the end of the day, or once you reach your goal, you can usually reflect back and say, that was fun. And so after my friend told me about type one and type two fun, she went on to point out that I'm a glutton for type two fun. And she's exactly right. All the adventures that I drag my family and my friends on usually are difficult, and they take effort. But at the end of it, we can usually say, you know, that was a great day, or that was fun. So we're flashing back to 2012, and I had just graduated from the University of Wyoming, and I was moving back to Valdez, Alaska with my boyfriend, Kyle. This is our hometown, and we were living with our parents as we were applying for jobs in Anchorage and working for the summer. And it was the middle of that summer in June when Kyle's friends had invited us to come out to a state parks cabin out in Chute Bay, next to Chute Bay Glacier, where we've heard about before today. And so as Kyle and I were talking about the weekend and trying to plan for it, he had suggested more the type one way, which is taking a motorboat, his dad's boat, with all of our friends and all of our gear out to the cabin and use that for our transportation. And then I instead suggested that we should do the type two way, and we should do the 12-mile hike that you can take to the cabins and hike out of the cabins. And if you haven't guessed it, Kyle is more of a type one fun kind of guy. So we go head to head a lot when we plan different activities. And so we compromised, though. We agreed that we would take our friends and our gear and his dad's boat out to the cabin. And then he said that, he agreed that he would hike back with me from the cabins back to Valdez while his friends took the boat back to the harbor. So we made it out to the cabin. We had a wonderful weekend. We were lucky with blue sky. The glacier was gorgeous. And we had lots of type one fun. So it was a third day, and we were ready to head back, and we were packing up our gear. And Kyle's friend suggested that we should put all of our camping gear, as much as we could fit, onto the boat and just have our backpacks as light as possible so that we could hike back as fast as we could. And I think secretly they kind of felt bad for Kyle that he was stuck with me having to hike back instead of take his own dad's boat back to Valdez. But anyhow, so we waved goodbye to our friends and they took off in the boat and we turned around to find the trailhead to start Chute Bay Trail. And what we miscalculated, and of the many things that we miscalculated about this trip, was that Valdez had huge snowfalls between the winters of 2011 and 2012. And it's they had about 34 feet of snow, which is 400 inches. And even though it was the middle of June, there was still about 3 feet of snow surrounding the cabin and on the shoreline as well. Which this should have been a red flag, but I just kept telling Kyle, like, no way, like, the snow's not going to stop us from doing this. Hike will be fine. This is okay. I just brushed it off all weekend. Well, we couldn't find the trailhead, but we had both previously done this trail, so we just started hiking in the general direction that we thought the trail would take. And we ended up finding a piece of the trail, but what we didn't anticipate was that there was late spring avalanches. And these avalanches had wiped out the trail. So even though we were able to find it, we would just lose it in 5 seconds. And so we tried different ways of trying to get across this avalanche debris or the field. We tried just hiking straight across it and trying to do kind of like a beeline. But we started sinking waist high into the snow, which is very slow for hiking. And and we just weren't doing very well. So then we said, okay, why don't we try to hike above the avalanche? So we hiked all the way up to the top, and there had formed these huge bodies of water because the sun was just beaming down onto the snow, creating these like lakes or puddles. So then we were getting drenched. So then we tried hiking below these avalanches, and if you've ever hiked in Valdez before, it's at the end of the northern rainforest, so it's bushwhacking. So you're just going through Devil's Club and alders, and it's very frustrating and very slow. So I tried to keep a good attitude because, after all, this is my kind of fun, and so I was just trying to get us along this hike. And I lost my good attitude at 9 hours into the hike. I looked down at my watch. We weren't even halfway through yet. We weren't even to the 6 miles yet in this 12-mile hike. And I was supposed to be home. And just to put some more context behind this, we were both only 21 years old, and my parents were strict, and they were not keen that Kyle and I were doing this weekend together, let alone now we're getting lost on the side of the mountain together. So I could only hear them in the back of my head just getting so angry at me. And so I just started to panic. I said, Kyle, we have to turn around. We're not even close to Valdez. We need to get back to the cabin. You know, we don't have shelter. We need to start a fire, all those kind of things. And we just thought, you know, end plan is we are not going to come home, and then our parents are going to come and take the boat and save us the next day. So that was kind of our plan. So we started to hike back. And we're just not really talking to each other. Well, Kyle didn't really want to talk to me. And so we were just pretty silent. And we ended up using a waterfall to get down to the shoreline, and then crossing this creek. And after crossing the creek, our toes were so cold, we lost feeling in them. And so we were massaging our feet, trying to get feeling back into our toes. And I just happened to look up. And there was a fisherman that was kind of within range of what I thought that I could yell at. So I just started jumping up and acting like a maniac and just saying, help, help, help. I like threw my backpack in the air, really dramatic. And Kyle luckily had his gun on him because it's where we were in notorious bear country. But he fired off a couple shots, and that actually got the fisherman's attention. So he ended up coming close to us. We worked it out where he was going to take us back to Valdez in a shouting match. And we ended up having to jump into the water and swim out to his boat because he was scared to come closer to us. He was afraid of his propeller. So we were freezing, just shivering in his boat as he was taking us back to Valdez. But I had this like relief about me because I'm like, man, we're making it home. This is great. And then he, as he was asking us questions, we had to humbly admit that we were from Valdez and barely got through a trail after 9 hours. And then he told us that he was from Canada, and this was the third time that he had been fishing in Alaska and the third time he had to save some hikers. So I was like, whoa, this is okay. And so he dropped us off at the city pier, and Kyle had cell phone service, so he called his mom. And anyhow, and we ended up making it, she drove me to my house, and I just, as we were reflecting on the day, before I got out of the car, I just started giggling, I looked at Kyle, and I said, that was fun though, right?
That was Addison Hayden.
And this is the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. This hour, we're hearing true stories about times Alaskans have epically failed.
Our last storyteller for this show is Nick Jenkins. He's a father, ski bum, guide, and wonderful storyteller. Here he is.
So I'm 19 years old, and I'm traveling north on a Patagonian highway. And as the bus comes to a halt at a Border Patrol checkpoint in between the countries of Argentina and Chile, I'm starting to get a little bit restless because this is the apex of my South American smuggling career. And I'm starting to sweat it a little bit. So rewind to 3 days previous. I'm in the southern part of Argentina, and I'm haunting my favorite section of the supermarket, the meat section. The meat in Patagonia is absolutely incredible. One of the reasons why they have good border patrol restrictions on it, because it's a huge part of their economy. And I'm walking around, and I catch out of the corner of my eye a glimmer of this green package. I know this green package. These are the best sausages in the entire world, and I'm drawn to it like a moth to a flame. And as I walk up, I'm trying to calculate exactly how many sausages I can eat in the next 3 days, because I have the bus ticket in my pocket. I'm gonna go across the border, and I know that I can't take these things with me. They'll confiscate them. So as I walk up and I square up to kind of this large section, I realize that they're not just the best sausages in the world, but they're on sale. And if there's two things I love more than anything in the entire world, it's sausages and it's sales. And at that moment, my brain short circuits and I forget all of that, and I buy every single sausage that I can get my hand on. And for the next 3 days, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, I am slamming these sausages. But I don't even make a dent, right? So I board the bus with this comically large satchel of meats. And as I pull into this checkpoint, I have the moment, right, where I have the choice. Do I declare these sausages and surely have them taken away? Or do I maybe alternatively declare these sausages and kind of leave it up to the gods? So I go with the latter. And I take the bag and I kind of twirl it, you know, to seal it. And I look around me, and everybody's kind of preoccupied. They're grabbing their backpacks, and they're going through, because it's this whole process. You put your bag on the conveyor belt and the whole thing, and everybody's doing their own thing. So I look around, and nobody's paying attention to me. So I take my bag, and I shove it right in between the seat and the window, and just instant gratification. This whole bag disappears. And I'm pretty smug with myself. Like, this is... this is a perfect crime. And I grab my backpack and I walk off the bus and I join the horde in the line. And not but 45 seconds later, a man in a fairly sharply dressed suit walks in through the double doors with my bag of sausages. I'm thinking, damn, these guys are efficient. These guys are really good at what they do. And he walks, and I'm watching out of the corner of my eye, mind you, and he walks right over to two large guards, big guns, South America, large military presence, and points directly at me. And I, again, short circuit, and I'm staring right at them, and they're walking at me, and my body just goes stiff. I'm flexing every muscle in my body, because my first instinct is to pee my pants, but I'm really holding it in. And so they come up and they grab my passport out of my hands, my backpack, and they half lead, half drag my rigor mortis body into the bowels of this compound. And they put me in the room and they search me thoroughly. And this is the room, mind you. SVU style, metal table, metal chairs, mirror wall. I'm detained. And these guys, they start just coming at me. And I do not have a lot to say, mostly because my Spanish is like, and my scared of Spanish is like, meh. Drunk Spanish? Meh. And so these guys are coming at me, and I can't understand a lot, but I understand some things, and I understand prison. Multiple years of prison, fine, tens of thousands of dollars in fine. This is a big deal, and they're making damn well sure that I know it. And this whole interrogation scene ends with them standing with their guns pointing at me and screaming, "Contrabandisto, contrabandisto." Smuggler, smuggler, confess, smuggler. And my only defense is that I have my hands raised above my head, and I'm saying back to them, "Solamente salchicha, solamente salchicha, only sausages, only sausages." And it's a bad defense, but it's the only one I had. So they get pretty fed up with this game because it's not really going anywhere. And they leave, and they ice me, right? It's a classic interrogation technique. And I'm sitting there, and I'd like to tell you that I was, like, super cool, calm, and collected. But I was not. I was freaking out. And while obviously South American prison is a terrifying thought, the main thing on the front of my brain was the thought of the phone call to my parents, letting them know that their teenage son had been seduced into the sexy and dangerous world of international sausage smuggling. And then I probably would not be coming home for a couple years. And so I'm like, I'm about to crack, right? And the first guy walks in, and he's, again, in a suit, and he's carrying the bag, and he sits across from me, and he speaks fluent English, almost without an accent, and speaks with an air of authority. And he tells me his story, which is he was sitting at his desk, and the bus pulled up, and not but 10 feet away watched me through his window twirl the bag, look around, and shove it in between the seat. So he tells me his story, and he tells me that he wants to impose the maximum penalty. But that I haven't technically done anything wrong. And he reaches into the bag and he points on the label where it says "Made in Chile" with a little Chilean flag next to it. And as it turns out, I had been trying to smuggle Chilean sausages back into Chile. Which, as it turns out, is not a crime. And so, with that, he reaches into his pocket and he throws me my passport, and I catch it in midair, and I am on my feet and I am to the door. I'm halfway through it. I can taste that freedom. And he yells, "Hey!" And my heart sinks. And I turn around to face him. And he asked me, "Don't you want your sausages?"
Thanks to Nick Jenkins for that story. Well, that's it for this episode of the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org.
The Arctic Entries website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard and the storytellers for this show, all of whom are volunteers, by the way. The proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also on our website.
Thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo. And thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.
I want to be yours, but I want to be free.